So, welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod,
episode 51.
So we're already charging towards the 100th.
Yeah, we're on the other side of 50.
We are.
We're already looking ahead to the big century.
Yeah, it might be a while. I wonder if we can get that in before the end of the year.
I don't think so. I think that'd be.
Yeah, that might be
pushing it. Anyway, we are back and on a more normal episode. Back on our normal species.
Shall I give you a little hint about what the episode's about? Wait.
It's
quite a big hint, actually.
Yeah, that's a nice sounding button.
Isn't that lovely?
So, if you haven't guessed it, we're going to be talking about the cuckoo, which is a bird that you have now photographed, but for a little while taunted you.
Oh, it taunted me a lot. I can't tell you how many times, because the problem with the cuckoos is they're not here for very long. They turn up in April and they disappear in June. And yes, they taunted me. I could hear them in the trees. I followed them. Sometimes I was convinced I was standing under the exact tree where I'd heard the cuckoo calling. And then 10 seconds later, the call would come from 200 yards away. And I could never get a picture of it. But yes, after about 2 years of chasing cuckoos around, I finally got one actually at RSPB Pulborough Brooks. And I just got lucky. I was standing up on an area that looked across a valley, and it just flew between two trees, and I just got this lovely shot.
It is a lovely photo as well.
And it's always a moment like that when you've been trying so hard to get a particular bird or a photograph of a particular bird, and then you finally get. And it's not just getting the shot, it's getting a decent shot.
Yeah,
you know?
Especially when it's flying. You've only got a small window.
Yeah, literally 10 seconds it went across me, and I managed to lock on and get a lovely shot. So, yeah, fascinating bird, which hopefully we'll find out about.
I feel like it's been a while since we've done a focus on just one species. We've done like invertebrates as a whole. We've done our 50th episode. Yeah. So it's nice to get back to researching about just one specific animal and learning all about it. And it's not, apart from seeing them and knowing the call, it's not really a bird I've properly looked into before. So I feel like I learned a lot. And I went down a few research rabbit holes because they were very interesting. Very late night as well, just not quite realising what the time was.
Yeah, I actually seem to have rather a lot of notes about the cuckoo, which is quite surprising because, like you say, it's not a bird. It's not a bird that's in the news too much.
No.
Albeit, as I've got into the bird photography and the conservation, they have actually come closer to my heart recently, which again we'll talk about a bit later on. So we better catch up.
Yeah, realize we got so excited about cuckoos, we just breezed past the catch up. I don't have a lot.
You know why we got excited about cuckoos?
Stop hitting buttons.
I'm sorry, the air horn didn't go down well, did it?
And I will be banning that sound.
Yeah, your mum gave me so much stick about the air horn. Loved the episode, hated the air horn.
Yeah, I think from next week or next episode, we might swap seats so you can't have the buttons.
Look, get off my buttons.
Catch-up wise, I don't have a huge amount other than, say, for the first time in ages, apart from our holiday, I've actually been out behind the camera and I sort of realised, had a slight panic and realised, you know, we're not that far off the end of summer when all the insects disappear, and I haven't spent enough time taking photos. So I have a little bit of a mission for the next month or so to be a bit more outside and behind the camera before the insects disappear again.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to spend some of the evenings this week in my sort of local nature reserves and fields trying to photograph some insects, which was really nice. But otherwise, not really any catch-up.
I haven't got much. It's gone a little bit quiet on the bird photography front. July and August is always a little bit quiet. There are obviously still birds about, but you know, they've all fledged their young. All that frantic activity of spring and everything has died down a little bit. Still some good birds to see on Pagham. There's still little terns and sandwich terns about, which is lovely to see them there this year and staying there and breeding there this year, because they got predated very badly last year and all disappeared. So just things like that. Just I've been doing my rangering and going out finding a few little local nature reserves, and that's about it really. Been a bit quiet.
Well, it's not a bad thing because we've got quite a lot to talk about.
I won't press the button.
Don't hit the button. No more buttons. Right, we're going to go straight into it. I'm going to talk all about the cuckoo. As it's a bird and you are the bird side of the Birdie Bug Pod, do you want to kick it off with a bit of background information about them?
Fascinating bird, the cuckoo. scientific name, we'll give you the scientific name, is, if I can pronounce it, and I'll probably pronounce it wrong, Cuculus canorus. There are four subspecies of the common cuckoo. There are actually, you can find them on every continent except Antarctica, apparently. And they inhabit a whole range of ecosystems, from dense tropical forests, grasslands, wetlands, and suburban gardens. I wish I had a cuckoo in my garden. I've never had a cuckoo in any of my gardens, so that would have been amazing. Highest diversity of cuckoo species is found in tropical and subtropical regions, Africa and Asia and South America in particular. And they are a migratory bird here, so they migrate from, they overwinter in Africa. They migrate to the UK in April time, so they're not around very long. By the end of June, they've pretty much all gone back. A fascinating bird in the way that they breed. They're primarily insectivorous. This is what I found quite fascinating, which I didn't know. They have a strong preference for caterpillars, especially those that are hairy or toxic to other birds. So they will eat beetles and grasshoppers and other invertebrates, but their ability to digest toxic prey gives them that competitive advantage. And maybe that's because, you know, they're not here very long, and competition is fierce from all the other migratory birds that have come in to breed over the summer here, the spring and summer here. So maybe that's given them some kind of advantage.
Yeah, is that they kind of fill a niche.
They will eat poisonous stuff or toxic stuff.
Yeah, well, I guess for migratory animals, it's hard to fill a niche. There's not many open niches in an ecosystem. No. So they've really got, like say, they've got to come and pick on something that's not being absolutely predated on by every other bird. They've got to come fill a quick niche and disappear off again.
Yes, so, and of course, they do have a very short window. A lot of the other migratory birds will turn up at the end of March and may not go back until September. So, you know, and sometimes those other migratory birds will have two broods through that period. So they're here a bit longer. So cuckoos have got this very short, small window, you know, to feed up and breed. So
just before we move on, I'm just going to go back slightly to their scientific name, because what I thought was quite cool is obviously the cuckoo call obviously gives it its name. The name is essentially what it yells. The genus Cuculus, again, sounds like the call, but the canorus, I don't know if that's how you said it, the species canorus apparently means melodious, which I thought was quite cool, because they are, it's a nice they little are. Melody,
it's,
isn't
it's
it?
Melodious.
I mean, it's probably why we've then stuck that sounding clocks and things like that, but I thought it was quite cool that the sound it makes not only has given it its name, the genus name, and the meaning of the species. So I just thought it was quite an impact for a sound of a bird.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that melody, I don't know anything about music as far as about writing and musical notes and what have you. Your mum understood this, obviously, because she's very musical. It's only the male cuckoo that does that.
Yeah, I think it was like two-note
cuckoo. They do a three-note one as well, but that iconic cuckoo sound is only done by the male. The first note is higher and louder than the second. And the difference between them has been described as the perfect descending minor third.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Which, of course, you understand what that means. Your mum played it to me on a piano, so she kind of understands all of that shiz. But so that's obviously
That's really cool.
The melodious bit. So, but it's only the males that make that iconic cuckoo, which is to advertise their presence on the breeding ground. So it's to tell all the other males and potential mates that they're here.
And it has very much sort of become the sound of spring. I think, you know, once you hear a cuckoo, you know the spring is here. I think that it's a lovely sign that spring has sprung.
Yeah, we'll touch on that a little bit later as well, because obviously that's from a cultural point of view. They've obviously been a sign and a signal of the start of spring. So, but we'll talk about that a bit later.
I guess before we jump to the cultural impact, should we talk about the most interesting part of a cuckoo?
I found it fascinating.
Egg and breeding behavior, because they are what's known as a brood parasite, which is basically it's their iconic behavior, where they don't build their own nests. They go and lay eggs in the nest of another bird and then disappear off and let the other birds rear their young for them, which again is why they don't need to be here for very long, because they can just lay their eggs. They don't need to raise their young. And
can you imagine
off
if
they
we
go.
Did that? Can you imagine?
Well, it's not the equivalent of dropping your kid off at a church doorstep, isn't it?
Well, just... and then never going back. Yeah.
So, yeah, no nest building. Females don't rear their own young. They have a variety of host species in the UK, things like meadow pipits, reed warblers, dunnocks, very occasionally wrens and pied wagtails, even robins. And it's just, this is where my rabbit hole sort of began, because the intricacies of this behaviour are absolutely fascinating.
It is fascinating. Now, we were touching on this as we were going to tennis this morning.
Yeah.
How, because there are things that have evolved over time with this brood parasitism. Is that the word?
Yeah.
And evolution has changed things for the cuckoo in respect of those birds that they are choosing to lay their eggs in. Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, so what's really interesting is that there are a variety of ways that the cuckoo gets away with this lifestyle, and it's in a proper like arms race with its host species, because obviously the host doesn't want to spend all that time, energy and effort rearing a chick that's not its own. But often ends up. And so there's a real evolutionary arms race between cuckoos trying to get better at sneaking their eggs into nests and the host birds getting better at recognizing that they're rearing the wrong kind of birds. Sometimes the photos are really funny because you've got like a tiny little, reed warbler or something raising a huge cuckoo chick.
Yeah, the size disparity is
and
incredible.
You're like, come on, have you not noticed?
Yeah.
But I mean, you've also got things like what's known as chick dominance. So after hatching, the young cuckoo chick will eject the host egg. So it will go through and throw all the other eggs out the nest, which will essentially inject a slight concern in the host bird, thinking, I've only got one chick left. I've got to give everything I can to make sure that this chick survives because all my other ones haven't. So it'll go through and throw all the other eggs out. And then obviously that means it gets sole access to the food. And they do grow rapidly. Like I say, they can be twice the size of the foster.
Well, that's the
parents.
Thing as well, is that the cuckoo egg hatches quicker than the host bird's
eggs. They've
got
time to sabotage.
So that's another evolutionary thing that they've done, is that they've made that their eggs don't have to incubate as long.
Yeah.
So obviously the cuckoo chick comes out first.
And so what will end up being really interesting to find out is, so they're known for what's called a egg mimicry, where the cuckoo egg laid by the female will mimic the host egg in colour and pattern, which again tricks the host in thinking, oh, this is one of my eggs, it looks like one of my eggs. And this is actually a genetic trait that's gone down through the female line, because you get different groups of females that specialise in different host birds, if that makes sense. So you'll have some cuckoos who will be, I don't know, reed warbler specialists, and their eggs will look like reed warbler eggs. And then you'll have dunnock cuckoos whose eggs look like dunnock eggs. And that is ended up being a genetic thing. And it looks like it's passed down through the maternal genes, because it doesn't seem to make a difference for them. The males don't seem to have a specialism. It's only the egg-laying female. So it's not like you get a dunnock specialist male looking for a dunnock specialist female or anything like that.
Yeah.
It is purely the female cuckoo. But they are incredibly adept at laying eggs that mimic their host's eggs.
Yeah,
and this is where our conversation
sort of kicked off. We talked about this, because I actually said, how has evolution done that? What has instigated that? What has started that process where the cuckoo realises that unless the egg looks like the host's eggs, it's going to get ejected.
Yeah,
so over time, and I don't know how many millions of years
many years, but this is where the conversation kicked off, because it's
and
that,
I couldn't understand what sparked that, what starts that process off.
Yeah, and so obviously we could do a whole episode on how evolution works, and so we won't, and I'll try and do it very quickly, but it's that you can't think of it as a conscious decision. Evolution did not decide in any shape or form that, oh, do you know what, if I lay an egg that's similar to this bird, I'll have an advantage. There was no decision process at all. It would have just happened to be, at some time, a cuckoo laid an egg that, with a bit of genetic variability, in the same way, like I said earlier, you know, kids will come out with slightly, my hair is not identical colour to yours or mum's, there's a bit of variability. A cuckoo would have laid an egg in a nest that just happens to be slightly more similar to that dunnock egg. And so it did slightly better. And maybe all the other cuckoos that laid eggs that didn't have this slight mutation that made it, you know, more similar to dunnock, they didn't survive quite so well. That slightly freckled egg or whatever it was survived. And so that cuckoo then went on, carrying that mutation, that trait from its parents, to then lay again a slightly freckled egg. And maybe in that young, the mutation was slightly stronger. Obviously, this happens over generations. It won't be each one. But it will just mean that generally, through time, as the eggs just happen to look slightly better and slightly more similar to the host, they were more likely to survive. The host isn't going to go, that's not my egg, and throw it out of the nest. And so over time, the birds that are surviving are the birds with a more similar egg, until we get to the point where, oh, they actually look really similar. Generations down the line, now we can go, that looks so similar to a Dunnock's egg. Right back at the beginning, it might have just been one freckle on the egg that made the Dunnock doubt it and keep it. But that's all it needed. So there was there's no conscious effort on the cuckoo side to be like, I need to lay a freckled egg or a green egg or whatever. It just, one of them would have had that variability. It survived better. That trait got passed down. It keeps on happening until we end up at the what stage we are now, where we can go, that looks really similar to a Dunnock's egg.
It is fascinating, isn't it?
I mean,
we could do a whole... But I'd like to do a whole episode all about that evolutionary process and how that works, because it happens obviously across the whole animal kingdom of things adapting and evolving for particular reasons. But it is fascinating. There's lots of things I found fascinating about that as well. Is that you know, if a female is raised, for example, by a reed warbler, it's absolutely certain that she will embark on a career of parasitizing reed warblers.
Yeah.
So that whole sort of genetic thing is instilled, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that's arguably the more interesting thing, because you can explain how over time the eggs look more similar, but because they parasitize different birds and then you end up with, you know, a female specialist, it's how they know they're a Dunnock specialist.
Yeah, because there is no genetic connection between the reed warbler and the cuckoo.
Yeah.
However, it's been, from all the studies, it's been proved that if it's been reared, a cuckoo has been reared by a reed warbler, it's almost certain it will go and then parasitize a reed warbler's nest.
Yeah, the only way I guess you can explain it is because, like I said, it seems like a trait passed on through the female.
Yeah.
And so it must be at some point they've separated out into these specialisms of what they prefer to parasitize, and there will be a gene in there somewhere that drives them to that nest. In the same way that, you know, birds have a genetic knowledge of where to migrate, they will have the genetic knowledge of, that's the bird I need to parasitize. How that developed and how it's split into different hosts is just one of those things where just evolution is incredibly...
It's mind-boggling.
Complex. But one that I've got... This is a thing I should have known... from my degree. So Bangor, please don't take my zoology degree off me. But I relearn. And this is my slight little quiz question for you, just out of interest. So obviously humans, we've got X and Y chromosomes. Females are XX and male are XY. And so it's actually the sperm, it's the male that determines the sex of the baby, because they're always going to get an X chromosome from their mum, and they will either get an X or a Y from the male.
Right.
But birds do not have XY chromosomes. They have two different letters. And I was just wondering if you know what letters are used for bird chromosomes instead of mammals.
Honestly, I have absolutely no idea.
No, I learned this in my degree and I forgot.
Absolutely no
idea. So they have WZ chromosomes instead of X and Y. And what's really interesting is, whereas...
I probably could have guessed that, because it would have been near X and Y,
sort of, but it's not an easy guess, and it's not a very nice question, but I just thought it'd be fun to pose it that way.
Well, fun for you,
What I also found really interesting is, whereas XX is female in humans, WZ is female, and the males are the ZZ.
Oh,
so they are the ones that have two of the same rather than one of each.
I wonder why it was...
Which will then, reasonable, I'll take it back to what I was talking about. That means that this host parasitism specialism is passed down through the female, so it must be in that W chromosome.
There's
something in there that tells females which host or which bird what they specialize in, and there will be a genetic component somewhere on that chromosome that's not carried by the male. I end up reading scientific papers. I went a very interesting evening.
Really enjoyed that, though.
Well, I'm not in academia anymore. What am I doing reading this at midnight? But it was really interesting.
Well, it is fascinating. You know, I've also found it fascinating that some host species are better at detecting cuckoo eggs than others. Black caps, for example, are really good. They make They appear to have really wised up to cuckoos' underhand tactics and are rarely parasitised. The worst one, apparently, is the dunnock. It says here, dunnocks, for instance, seem to be especially clueless
and
almost always accept a bogus egg. But as you said earlier on, it's often reed warblers, sometimes robins. Dunnocks, meadow pipits are another one that seems to be a very popular popular choice. But I also found it fascinating because sometimes cuckoos get mistaken for sparrowhawks.
Yes, I've seen one fly across the New Forest and think, oh, is that a sparrowhawk?
They have that sort of barring on their chest, which is very similar to the gray speckled and barring that sparrowhawks have. And they think there's a reason for that because meadow pipits and dunnocks and reed warblers are a
prey.
Yeah, prey for sparrowhawks. So they think that the cuckoo uses that to get the birds to leave their nest temporarily.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they'll fly over.
Yeah, clear.
They'll get freaked. They'll clear off. That hasn't got to be for very long because the cuckoo can go in and lay an egg
rapidly,
faster than probably any bird in the world. It can lay an egg within 10 seconds and be gone. So they think that barring
is really
again an evolutionary trait that is mimicking a sparrowhawk, is helping them to lay their eggs in a nest.
Yeah, and I mean, we've actually spoken before this episode that after having chats about this, that we'd quite like to do a whole episode on evolutionary arm races, because there is an arm race going on between cuckoos and the birds that they parasitize, because they do have these little dunnocks and these birds, they do have defense mechanisms. Yeah. They will do things like eject the egg from the nest if they notice it, if the mimicry is not quite up to scratch, or they come back and be like, hang on, I've got three instead of two. They'll also sometimes just abandon the nest entirely because there's such a high risk of the cuckoo, you know, throwing their eggs out of the nest that it's not worth looking after them, which is a bit sad.
And sometimes they drill into the eggs, don't they?
They'll also bury the foreign egg underneath the like nesting material and things like that. And like you said, different birds sort of have different abilities to recognise it. And things like reed warblers are quite good at ejecting eggs, whereas dunnocks are not so much.
I felt that was a bit harsh.
But this, where the arms race comes in, this is... It's interesting because this drives the mimicry even further. So as host birds get better at recognising it, only those cuckoos who are laying really good, confusing eggs will survive, which means their ability to mimic an egg gets even better, which then forces the host birds to get even better. And so it ends up driving the two of them in this arms race of who's going to win. Will the cuckoo lay an absolutely perfect egg, or will the dunnocks finally, you know, clue up and realise that that's not my egg?
But you see, the chicks have also got another trick. Did you know about this?
Which one?
The cuckoo chick has another trick up its sleeve or up its wing. It's able to mimic the sounds of a whole nest of host chicks.
Oh, yes.
Tricking the bird into bringing enough food to raise it. So isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it's all this driving it, because they've got to make sure that they can lay an egg in there and have it raised. Otherwise, they're in trouble. And the host is fighting so hard not to. But what's quite interesting is that it does seem to vary quite a lot, not just by species, but by region. So in some regions, the birds are better at not being fooled by cuckoos than others. And apparently this is through to a whole range of things. And sometimes it's just been essentially the abundance of cuckoos. You know, are there a lot more of them around, so birds have more time, which is interesting because if climate change starts pushing their region further or wider, then they might end up in locations. Perhaps the dunnocks and the reed warblers in that region have never even seen a cuckoo, and then suddenly you're going to have cuckoos mimicking it brilliantly, and they've never had to deal with this problem. So if their region or their sort of area starts to change, then you might sadly see a decline in our non-cuckoo birds, because they haven't had to fight cuckoos for however many generations, and they're not prepared to try and notice.
Yeah, now that's a really interesting point. And of course, we'll cover that a little bit on the, as we always do, we talk about the threats and the current situation that cuckoos are in at the moment. Really interesting point.
Yeah, the last thing I'll also notice is that sadly there are also cases of hosts actually mistakenly ejecting their own eggs, thinking it might be a cuckoo egg. And so they parasitized, but they are so hardwired to try and detect false eggs that they've actually then just thrown their own eggs out because they don't want to waste the energy on raising a cuckoo, and there was no cuckoo in the first place. So it's a real battle going on between some of our little birds and the cuckoo, and but it's an interesting one.
It is a fascinating one. And of course, you know, the cuckoo is the only bird, I think, in the world.
I think it might be the only brood parasite. People can correct us if we're wrong there.
Which in itself is fascinating. So, okay, so we talked a little bit about the way it will breed.
Their lifestyle. Could have talked for ages. They're so interesting.
And, of course, we talked earlier on about the fact that they are a migratory bird. They come in from late April, go depart in about June. The young cuckoos will go slightly later in the year once they've fully fledged from their host nest. And where do they go? So the UK ones will go down into Western Africa. Some of them go quite far down into tropical Africa for the whole of the winter. You know, the distances they travel and in the time span that they travel in is quite incredible. So with what distances are we talking about? It's a very long way. Shortest distance between London and tropical African countries such as Ghana or Nigeria is about 4,800 kilometres, which is about 3,000 miles. Some of them go all the way down to South Africa, not many, and that's 6,000 miles or 9,600 kilometres. And so they migrate huge distances in quite a short space of time.
Just on their migration, what I found quite interesting is that there's two routes that they can take.
Yeah.
So there's a western route, which is sort of Spain and Morocco and then into Africa. So I've got it down as Iberian Peninsula, Morocco, Sahara, yeah. West Africa. And then you've got the eastern route, which is the sort of Italian and Balkans route, which is the Alps, Italy, Libya, Central Sahara, and Central Africa.
Yeah.
And again, it seems to be you've got populations who will always take the western route and you've got populations who will always take the eastern route. But interestingly, the western route has a higher mortality rate, possibly because they've got to cross the Sahara Desert, which makes refueling trickier. And I've got more on the...
It could be that, or it could be hunting that goes on over southern Europe. Although they have that problem in Spain as well. There's a lot of bird hunting that goes on over Spain. And a lot of them go across to Portugal and Spain, as you say, and then down into Western Africa.
Yeah. But I find it interesting that they've actually got two routes. And the one thing I found was that the western route has higher mortality. So you'd think, well, why are they still taking that route? And from the BTO, they said that they think the western route persists despite this apparent disadvantage because the conditions leading to that increased mortality are a recent development, which we will go into when we talk about the decline and the struggles they're having. But potentially before, you know, climate change and all the stuff that we'll talk about, the western route was probably fine, and it's actually only a recent thing that's making one route more favourable, because otherwise it makes no sense how they've survived. Why would you not just take the eastern route?
It'll be interesting to see
how that changes.
As if that mortality rate keeps going, whether they then, you know, change.
Yeah.
Whether they change their routes to accordingly.
But I'll save that for the decline, which I don't know if you want to go on to now. Have you had your... Because you've got some cultural things you feel
Yeah, I mean, there's loads and loads of cultural things, mostly, to be honest, about the, you know, the beginning of spring. Loads of associations with the arrival of spring and good fortune and cultural significance in lots of different countries, actually. So Celtic and Irish traditions... the cuckoo was associated with the transition between worlds and was often linked to themes of death and rebirth. So that was Celtic and Irish. Lots of Irish cultural references, actually. So one popular was belief that you should have money in your pocket the first time you hear the cuckoo to ensure prosperity through the year.
Oh, that's interesting.
Another tradition held being in good health upon hearing the first cuckoo call of the season was a sign of good health for the rest of the year. In Donegal, anything out of the ordinary was termed a winter cuckoo. So if you happen to hear a cuckoo's call while you're planting potatoes, you could expect to find what are known as cuckoo potatoes later in the year, implying a poor crop. And then, of course, in British folklore, the cuckoo is a trickster figure.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Admired for its cleverness, but also viewed with suspicion. Its parasitic habits have led to an association of infidelity and deceit. And, of course, it was mentioned in Shakespeare's Love, Labour's Lost. Do you want me to read you a little bit? Do you like a bit of Shakespeare?
I mean, I'm not a big Shakespeare fan, but there might be some out there.
I don't know whether I can do it justice. When daisies pied and violets blue and lady smocks all silver white and cuckoo buds of yellow hue do paint the meadows with delight, the cuckoo then on every tree mocks married men, for thus sings he, cuckoo, 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 a word of fear unpleasing to a married ear. So Shakespeare used references to cuckoo.
Oh, there you go. I bet when you clicked on an episode about cuckoos, you weren't expecting a little bit of Shakespeare in there.
No, a little bit of Shakespeare.
I feel like they would be good, I don't know, symbols of assassins or something, sleeper spies. You know, you've planted them in the nest and reared them, and, you know, little sleeper agents.
Yeah. I like that.
That's how I view them anyway.
Yeah, I think that's good. In Russia, the cuckoo holds a significant place in folklore, being associated with death and the afterlife.
As a sleeper agent, there we go.
The bird is believed to be a messenger from the spirit world, and its call was used in divination practices to predict events such as marriage and longevity. So lots and lots of cultural references.
Yeah, so they've had a real impact.
Mainly about the advent of spring, yeah, and the
and
fortune for the year. And lots of references, lots of things have used the cuckoo's name. So there are lots of things in nature that also have the cuckoo's name. There's a cuckoo flower, which is also known as Lady's Smock, which is a common wildflower that blooms in spring. And its reference to the cuckoo is, again, typically because it appears at the beginning of spring. Cuckoo spit, of course, was a frothy white substance that's found on the stems of plants in spring and early summer. Nothing to do with the cuckoo apart from the fact it always appears beginning of spring.
Obviously, we spoke earlier about the cuckoo bee.
There is a cuckoo bee applied to a species of bee such as those in the genus Nomada, which do not build nests of their own but instead lay their eggs in the nests of other bee species. The cuckoo clock was inspired by the call of the cuckoo. Very famous, isn't it, the call of the cuckoo clock? I liked this one. Cuckoo land is an idiom that signifies fancifulness, delusion, or unreality. They're in cloud cuckoo land is a very well known phrase.
Yeah, you're absolutely cuckoo, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. And cuckoo's nest was a term entered popular language as a term for a place of madness or psychiatric institution, and it was famously used in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a very famous film all about insanity. And then your brother actually told me about this one, which I didn't
know.
Which
brother?
Your elder brother.
Oh, my older one.
Your officer, Woodard, PC Officer Woodard, told me about cuckooing. Cuckooing is when organised crime groups or perpetrators take over properties through force, deceit or coercion. It's often included with county lines activity occurring when gangs take control over a vulnerable adult's address as a site to store, supply, produced drugs from. And in fact, if you watch Line of Duty, I think there was a reference to that in Line
That's
of Duty.
That's interesting.
Where
yeah.
somebody took over a Down syndrome's lad's flat and stored body parts in his freezer. And so I didn't know that.
No,
that was
again,
a word
makes
cuckooing.
Sense, doesn't it?
So that makes sense. So there's lots of little references.
Yeah, well, they've had quite a cultural impact, really,
yeah,
cuckoos.
But very much so, yeah. So so shall we crack on and talk about conservation and the environmental
stuff? Well, we should probably
stuff?
Kick it off with talking about their decline and their challenges that they face.
Yeah, it's not good reading.
No, I mean, so the decline of the common cuckoo in the UK, particularly in England, has been quite steep and also pretty well documented, with populations falling by over 65% since the 1980s and over 70% in some of the southern areas. I will say, in contrast, cuckoo numbers in parts of Scotland and upland regions have actually remained quite stable and even increased in some parts.
And in Wales as well, apparently.
There are areas where they're doing better, but certainly down in the southern parts of England, they're doing not so well. And we'll go into it. The decline is due to quite a complex combination of ecological climate and migratory factors, which is interesting because so often, and we'll talk a little bit about land use change, but in general, a lot of the species we've spoken about have sort of suffered from the same challenges, whereas as a migratory bird, they seem to have some slightly different things that they're contending with.
Yes, which is making it even more challenging, and they are listed as vulnerable on the global IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, so they are in trouble. And there are some very obvious reasons why, and actually, quite sadly, not particularly easy ones to address.
No, they are quite a bit harder, I think, to tackle.
So do you want to crack on with that?
Yeah, I think the thing that I found most interesting, and is possibly the hardest one for us to solve, are the issues around their migration and how that ties into things like climate change. So I mentioned earlier, of course, that they have two routes, and the western route is not quite so favourable. They have a higher mortality rate than those that take the eastern route. And the thought being that it must have persisted because the issues that are causing the high mortality must be quite recent. And so one of the things that they are associating that sort of higher risk with is essentially the desertification and habitat loss in certain parts of Africa.
Yeah.
So the bits that they would normally fly over and stop off and refuel and things like that, they were finding good refueling stations. But as the climate's changed, it's got hotter, you're losing some of the habitat. It's forcing them to have longer flights over things like the Sahara. They're not able to stop off and rewater and refuel, which then means they don't have the energy to continue their mighty flight across. And it's the same for parts of Europe. We're seeing a lot more drought. Obviously, there are human factors, changes in land use, habitat loss and stuff like
normal,
that.
The normal changes in agricultural practices.
But a combination of the climate changing and the human changing means that their little stop-off stations across Africa and Europe before they get here are not as fruitful. They're not able to feed up really well and rest and refuel, which just means they don't have the energy to make their flights, which means they're not essentially succeeding in their migration routes as often. And sadly, that's not easy to address and is probably set to only get worse. We're only seeing more drought and harsher temperatures, so it's a tricky one for them. They're losing their stop-off service stations.
I think climate change is the biggest issue here, and that's a very good point that you've put there. That's not something that I'd read about, actually. But climate change is having a huge effect on their migratory patterns. Sometimes they're migrating slightly later. And, of course, the cuckoo is so intricately linked to the hosts that it uses. Yeah,
who are here year-round.
So any factor that affects the host abundance or that distribution has a ripple effect on cuckoo populations, but also the other way around, in so much as if the cuckoo is migrating slightly later, then it's putting it slightly out of balance with the nesting habit of the birds that it's using for hosts. So if it's coming slightly later and the meadow pipits and the reed warblers have already laid their eggs, so they're possibly laying their eggs and nesting earlier, the cuckoo is leaving Africa slightly later because of the changing climate. So all of that imbalance then is having this huge ripple effect.
Yeah, it's a real mismatch.
It's so intricately linked that any slight imbalance is catastrophic in actual fact.
We've spoken obviously a lot about evolution. These birds have evolved together, and which is why their timing is so perfectly linked. And climate change is happening at such a rate. Evolution happens over such a long period of time, and the climate and human impacts as well. But the climate change here has happened so quickly that, like you say, the cuckoos might arrive and the host birds have already hatched. Yeah. And so if an egg appears in a nest full of chicks, it's quite easy to notice.
And sometimes it could be the other way around, that the cuckoo has left earlier and the host birds
aren't nesting
because it's the imbalance is here as well. Yeah. So in all of our episodes, on most of our episodes when we've talked about threatened species, we can normally, point at factors where people are working so hard to restore habitat and to create those ideal environments for birds to thrive or to get back on their feet. And it's not so easy.
No.
This one is not an easy one because you can't just suddenly stop climate change.
And you also humans can't then go and, I don't know, make birds nest later or earlier.
There are things we can do, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But
I mean, so essentially the climate change issue here that we're talking about is they're missing their breeding window. Yeah. They're either turning up early or late, and they're not able to essentially slide their egg into a nest full of other eggs. So that is a real issue. The other big problem is... I say, we've got loss of habitat, fragmentation, and that obviously leads to things like a big decline. We've spoken about this in insects in general, but a big decline in caterpillars.
Yes.
And they rely on that niche of, we eat the caterpillars that nobody else wants. And if those caterpillars suddenly disappear and all the birds, they're already contending and competing for reduced insect population as it is. It's not like there's an abundance of other insects to go around, which is why they like to rely so heavily on things that other birds don't eat. If those caterpillars suddenly disappear, they turn up here and they haven't got any food. Yeah. Same as on their journey, the food that they want on, in those refuel stations is not available. But crucially, when they get here and they need the energy to produce an egg and all that sort of stuff, their food source is disappearing. And now we'll talk about it when we look at the conservation efforts. That's something that we can do more about. We can try and, you know, make sure there's good habitat for the caterpillars that they like to eat, and make sure that they've got sort of foraging rich areas and all that sort of stuff. And that's a problem with both climate change, but also the common things that we talk about: increased pesticide use, a decline in a lot of their sort of heathy natural woodland habitat, and a lot more sort of monoculture that doesn't support the diversity of butterflies and caterpillars and things like that. So the loss of, I mean, we've done a whole episode on hedgerows is another big one.
Yeah.
So it's a loss of hedgerows and rough grassland and scrub and things like that, that is really where their caterpillars absolutely thrive. And
they've been doing a lot of studies on the decline in the moth species that the obviously had the caterpillars that the cuckoos particularly like.
Tiger moths and oak eggers.
Yeah, and they are able to obviously correlate the two and realise that that decline in that moth species in particular areas is having a big effect on whether the cuckoos even appear in those areas because of that decline. So,
Actually, the one thing I forgot to throw in there, when I've spoken about the eastern and western route, I mentioned obviously just before we spoke about the decline that England and southern England populations have been hit the hardest, whereas the Scottish and sort of more northern populations are doing slightly better. This correlates with apparently, typically, the cuckoos that come to England favour the western route. And so
the
populations in England are declining as the mortality route of the western route flying cuckoos goes up, and which is being impacted by climate change. And so it's interesting that it's our southern birds that favour that route. And it's correlating quite
that
nicely.
That makes perfect
sense.
Not
nicely,
it?
But it adds up. So it all ties into the story of this changing climate.
Yes, it does. And as we've said, it's as far as us trying to, you know, put some hope and good news stories on the end of this episode, it's a tricky one.
I have a few. I feel like we've spoken a lot about the cuckoo. We actually said a few days ago, it might be a shorter episode because of doing species. Then we both got so enamored by this bird that our research
And
really...
I haven't talked about Wilfred yet, have I?
No, you mentioned him in the last episode, but you'd have to give him a shout out. So shall we move on to the conservation and the positive efforts?
Yes.
I think one of the massive one here is the satellite tracking and research done by the BTO, which
the BTO
I haven't
written
a lot about because I know it's a project very close to your heart.
It is close to my heart because I do sponsor a cuckoo, and everybody can go onto the BTO site, look at the cuckoo tracking project, and you can choose a cuckoo and sponsor, and you can donate as little or as much as you can. It's an amazing gathering of data. They're trying to gather obviously as much data to do with the migratory patterns.
It's a huge project.
Massive project. And it's not just UK birds, they're tracking birds that are travelling from Mongolia down into Zambia. It's going on all across the world. And it's absolutely vital for gathering as much data as they can to monitor the migratory patterns of cuckoos
and then
from that data they can ascertain, a bit like you were talking with this western route or central route or whatever, they can monitor the changing patterns and then try and ascertain why the declines are happening, where those critical points are.
It's
a brilliant, it's a really, really important, and one of the very few conservation projects at the moment going on around cuckoos.
I was gonna say, it's all the data that I've spoken about today, mortality rates, migration routes, that's all come from the BTO. This project's been going on since 2011. Like you say, one of the really important things, obviously I've spoken about them not having these stopover sites to refuel. The tracking is vital for identifying where they're stopping over, and if they're struggling in places, then whether or not it's in the UK or across their route, you know, Africa and Europe, you can identify where they need help. It's like, okay, so a lot of them are hitting this part of their migration route and not surviving. We need some habitat restoration in this part of Europe if our cuckoos are going to make it back to us.
I mean, there has been, you know, I think when I sponsored Wilfred, I think there was 15 or 18 you could choose from. And then by the end of that season, that April to June, You know, because if you sponsor them, you get little updates. You can put your email address in and they'll give you an update on where your bird is and where all the rest of them are. And of course, some of them don't make it. There's been some sad ones where, oh, it's really sad to say that Nick 2 has not made it.
Oh,
and
no.
We haven't got any signal back from him now. But it's a really heartwarming thing to watch, though. And
yeah, I know you get very excited when Wilfred makes it back to us.
Wilfred's an absolute star. He tends to be the last one to leave. This year he's the last one to leave, and he's been going back to Wallington Marshes in Suffolk, where he was first tagged. And he makes the same journey every year to West Africa, and he covers massive distances in very short space of time. For example, on the 9th of July, in just 2 days, he went from Wallington Marshes into central Spain, where he covered nearly 930 miles. And then when he left the Iberian Peninsula, he went straight across the border of Spain and Portugal, crossed the Gulf of Cadiz and followed the Moroccan coast before heading inland and continuing into Western Sahara. And he did this in about 3 days.
Yeah,
and
it was quite staggering. Sort of think of big soaring migratory birds, you know, cruising. And yeah. They're not huge birds.
Bigger than a blackbird.
So, I mean, their wingspan's 55-60 centimetres. They're about 110 to 130 kilos. So they're about dove-sized is what I've got written down.
Yeah.
So they're not massive, and they cover these distances at an incredible rate.
So I'll put a link on it, obviously, in the story notes, but if you can, it's a great thing to do. And I get really excited when I see that Wilfred's last out and first in.
I still think
when he left Africa to come back to Suffolk, he was first back, even though he was last to leave. So he must be a bit rapid, Wilfred.
Yeah, I do think that next time he's back in the UK, because he's often down here in the south, we should go and see if we can hear him.
I need to go and find Wilfred. He's close to my heart now,
I think,
Wilfred.
I mean, can you imagine if you got a photograph of Wilfred? It would be incredible.
He's a good-looking bird as well. You can see he's got a picture of him on the BTO. He's a lovely-looking bird.
He's a good lad.
He's a good lad.
Yeah, so the BTO tracking and research is absolutely... I mean, we've spoken in so many episodes the importance of data and the fact that...
Yeah.
Apart from the fact that you actually need the data to identify where to do restoration, you need the data to convince people. So, you know, if the mortality rate's dropping, population's going, you can pick out hotspots where they're struggling. Yeah. That is very important for building the case to be like, we've got all this data, they need help here, do it. So it's vital. But as we said, it's tricky to try and combat the climate change issues. One of the things we can do is the habitat restoration here in the UK to make sure that when they do get here, they've got the habitat they need, the food they need, and source, sadly, the birds that they need to parasitize. So I've got a few examples. I've got Wicken Fen, which is a Cambridgeshire place.
Famous, really famous
there's
location.
There's a actually. Project between the National Trust and the BTO. Apparently there's long-term cuckoo monitoring there, behavioural studies as well. Apparently it's formed quite a backbone of our understanding of their ecology across England. A lot of studies have been taking place on the population at Wicken Fen, but there's a lot of habitat management, mainly supporting things like reed warblers, because they need the population of reed warblers. So obviously it benefits the reed warblers as well. It always seems a little bit sad that you're trying to make sure they're okay so the cuckoos can come and use them. But also things like making sure there's really insect-rich habitats.
I think that's the key, isn't it? Like you were talking, you touched on the caterpillar and moth populations
and
decline.
Again,
so
I mean, when we've done a whole episode on the importance of invertebrates, that only benefits the rest of the ecosystem anyway, but it also helps the cuckoo. I've also got the Dartmoor Cuckoo Project, which is actually led by the RSPB, the BTO, and Exeter University, as well as Dartmoor Upland Bird Nest Group, which is quite a mouthful. But it's a long-term sort of initiative that focuses on the habitat use, the nest preferences, the ecological drivers for the cuckoo population around Devon. They've done all sorts of things like cuckoo call monitoring, which is data that's gathered by people we always mention. The citizen scientists are out there monitoring cuckoo calls and things like that. The timing of when they start hearing the calls of when
you can do that
arriving.
As well on the BTO. You can actually go and sign up for that on the BTO.
As well as volunteer surveys to map their presence and their nesting areas across Dartmoor. And again, contributes to really good habitat restoration of trying to make sure there's this natural moorland and meadow pipit availability is actually the big one. Over
it's wetland and heathland conservation as well is really important.
And then the RSPB have a couple of sites. Minsmere is one which is actively managed to make sure that reed bed, heathland, wet grassland and scrub is really looked after, which again is fantastic for all the other birds, but it supports reed warblers, which is a primary host for the cuckoos, and maintains those insect-rich zones. At North Warren and Stumpshaw Fen, RSPB reserves manage, again, reed beds and wet meadows, and they do all sorts of different techniques just to try and make sure that reed warblers and things like meadow pipits are thriving. And obviously, like I say, in some way, it's bittersweet. You're looking after birds so that another can parasitize it, but it's so important for the whole ecosystem. They're looking after the habitat, the insect population, boosting everything else, which means the ecology works as it should. You need parasites and prey to keep all the other populations in check.
It's always a balance, but at the moment it's a big imbalance, and all of that habitat restoration can only be beneficial for the rest of the wildlife and the biodiversity. So it's all good. That kind of stuff's all good. And you can even help in your own gardens by growing native plants and shrubs that attract caterpillars and moths and other insects that the cuckoos feed on, because they will stop over in people's gardens if you've got a big enough plot.
We've spoken about it quite a lot, the impact that if everybody had a slightly wild garden, it creates a real mosaic of good habitat.
And cutting down on the use of chemicals and pesticides in your garden. Yeah. Even, you think it's tiny little changes don't make a difference, but they really do.
We've said it before, and it's a figure or a stat that I absolutely love, that all of our gardens add up to a greater area than our national parks. And so
so important. I mean, I've cut down, I've got no chemical use at all in my garden. I know I've said this lots of times in lots of episodes. I've had more bees, butterflies, hoverflies, and insects and birds in my garden this year than ever before. And that change has taken place over 3 or 4 years, where I have used no chemicals, and now gradually that insect population, invertebrate population, has really increased in my garden this year. I've seen it so obvious.
Yeah, and then you took a cracking photo recently, which is over on your Instagram, of house sparrows eating the aphids off your plants.
My natural pest control,
which is exactly how it's supposed to work.
It's not just the sparrows, the blue tits have been doing it, and the hoverflies have been doing it, and the ants I know the ants farm them, they farm the aphid, but the birds come in and eat the ants, so it's all
proper ecosystem
generating, and it's brilliant.
So it's a bit of a sad thing that it's so hard for us to combat the climate impact on their timings and all of that, but there is still a lot of work being done to make sure that when they do get here, there's habitats rich with caterpillars and rich for the birds that they can stick their eggs in the nest.
They're a fascinating bird. Absolutely fascinating bird. And it would be a very, very sad thing if you didn't hear this in the British countryside.
It is a lovely sound.
It's such an iconic sound.
That might be my favourite button that you've got. I think that's pretty much all I've got. I went through such a rabbit hole of genetics. It was so interesting to research how they've become specialised for different animals and the hereditary nature of that. And they're just, like I say, maybe we have got this wrong, but I'm pretty sure they are the only brood parasite. And the fact that that's evolved,
I think
is
they
just...
are.
It's just fascinating.
And as it was maybe going to be a short episode, we're now up to 55 minutes.
Oh, that's so not nearly, as bad. I thought we'd gone longer than
nearly
that.
Done an hour, but I think we might have covered
I think they deserve
everything we need to on the cuckoo.
They deserve an hour. So what you need to do is stay tuned to find out if next year we can go and find Wilfred. But in the meantime, go and have a look at the birds being tracked by the BTO.
Yeah.
Pick your favourite.
Yeah.
See when they make it back. It's really great.
It is great. And like I say, if you can donate, because obviously it costs a lot of money to do all of this tracking and data and accumulate it all. And, so if you can donate, that's brilliant.
Yeah,
I don't work for the BTO, so, I'm just a volunteer. I'm a volunteer, but it's heartwarming just to know that even if it's £5, it's something.
Yeah, and we will obviously stick lots of links in the show notes about if you want to be a citizen science for them or get involved in cuckoo call monitoring and all that sort of stuff.
Record cuckoo sightings, anything like that. It's all so valuable.
But there we are. Hopefully you've enjoyed the episode on was just a fascinating bird. Yeah. I've always known, I knew there were parasites and I knew a little bit about them, but I think I've got a whole new interest and respect for the cuckoo.
And I found that evolutionary process absolutely fascinating. So we will touch on that again, I'm sure.
It sparked some new episode ideas for us as well. Yeah. So I'll do the normal social media thing. Obviously go and follow us over at the Birdie Bug Pod on Instagram, hopefully. And I've said this a few times, but I've actually designed stuff now. New content coming very soon. I've actually been filming a little vlog for this episode, which will be out beforehand. But if you haven't seen it and you want to find out what we actually get up to when we record an episode, I'll do a little behind the scenes video. We do record it, but we also do quite a lot of tennis and drink quite a lot of coffee. So if you want to see what goes into these episodes, then head over to our Instagram. If you've seen a cuckoo, if you know a fact about them that we haven't covered, then please do drop a comment or send us a message. We would love to hear from you. But otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, catch you next time. Look forward to it. Bye-bye.